Yesterday, the president made a surprise visit to U.S. troops in Iraq, and the Iraqi parliament is calling for a vote to expel U.S. forces. So we're going to bring in CBS military analyst Major Mike Lyons. Good morning, Mike.
Hey, good morning, Colleen. Great to be with you.
Good to have you on the show. When it comes to the expulsion of U.S. troops, is it likely that the Iraqi parliament would vote to do that?
I don't think so. I think they're obviously concerned about the president coming to Iraq and not meeting with the prime minister. I just think they're using this for some political fodder right now. The two main groups within the Iraqi parliament are both pretty much against what America is doing. They do want to change America's role inside of Iraq as Iraq becomes more stable. But the bottom line is this: the president had to fly through Iraqi airspace in order to get there. The Iraqi government was given a heads up. They likely knew that he wasn't going to meet the prime minister. And I just think this is a reaction from a political perspective.
And the president was criticized for waiting this long to visit U.S. troops in an active combat zone. But he did. And I'm sure, Mike, that it meant a lot to the troops there.
It sure did. And you saw from the pictures and the president, you know, signing autographs and things. And the thing about it is, when you visit a combat zone, you still have got to prepare well in advance. And it's not something that you can turn on very quickly. It's not like he was reading the criticism over the weekend and decided he was going to go there. The week was planned well in advance. You had to have people on the ground. You had to have a lot of things already in place. It's turned off quickly. I'm sure there was others planned that they just got turned off. And he was concerned about the security environment, as he said in that press conference during the meeting.
Sure. Now, when it comes to his decision about pulling troops, you know, let's talk about Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, where we have troops fighting. Could we see a time during this administration where all troops are pulled out of all areas and we see an end to this seemingly endless war?
Yeah, that'd be a major change. And I think the president instinctively wants to do that. But there is more of a purpose between troops in Iraq and Afghanistan than what's going on in Syria. Syria definitely started out one way. We've got mission creep now. The troops there, you hear them, they're there to deter Russia and Iran. That's not what they were there for at the very beginning. So I do think his instinct's right about that. It's different in Afghanistan, different in Iraq. We're trainers there. We're helping them build capacity in both organizations. You got to look at maybe in Afghanistan we'll reduce it by somewhat, but I don't think we'll be leaving Iraq anytime soon.
And, you know, people talk a lot about, you know, winning, or is this a repeat of the Vietnam War? What happens if we do pull out and ISIS gains traction again?
Right. That's exactly the analogy, the Vietnam War. It's similar to, you know, late 50s, early 60s when JFK put special forces, Green Berets, into Vietnam as trainers. And you saw the mission creep take place there. And that's the risk that happens here. You know, those American troops, for example, inside of Syria, if they were to be attacked by somebody, if we lost 20 of them like we lost in Mogadishu about 25 years ago, what would the response be? I think we've got to think through all of these missions and think through and make sure that we're putting the right amount of thought into the application of military force, combining it with the diplomatic force. The bottom line is this also. Syria is in Iran and Russia client state at this point. There's no other way around it. We gave away Syria to the Russia during the Obama administration.
And the president also calling for the U.S. to pull out of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. Again, a dramatic shift from previous administrations, not something you hear often. But some fear that this could set us up for another Cold War arms race. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, if we do, I think we'd win that easily in terms of how we could quickly bankrupt Russia, as we did back during the Cold War at the end of it, the way it worked out. But the bottom line is the Russians have developed these missiles that violate the treaty, and the treaty restricts us in areas in the South China Sea where China is building up the capability. So it's time for a fresh relook at all of those treaties. Now, they're hard to negotiate as they're, you know, moving trains, and they often go over multiple administrations. Those original SALT II and nuclear disarmament treaties went over multiple administrations. The question is, what's the will of the political will of the leader in order to get them done right now? It looks like the president wants to back away from them.
And Mike, with all of your experience and all of your expertise, it can be, you know, hard for people to hear above the major headlines for all of this, with pulling troops out of Syria, with this pulling out of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, possibly, you know, a lot of the fear headlines that are out there, that this is the wrong thing to do. We're going to start a Cold War. We're going to lose to ISIS. Da-da. You know, with all of your experience and expertise, how should we understand the moves from this administration?
Yeah, that's a great question, because all you get is outrage from the media. We're losing our minds last week over literally 2,500 troops being possibly removed from Syria. I guarantee that those 2,500 troops are not the linchpin to maintain security in the Middle East. I think we've got to take this one step at a time, look for other opinions, look for alternates. I think there's other threats in the world. We have a greater threat actually in the Pacific with China as they build up their military. But I do believe that one step at a time, there are smart people in the White House. The foreign policy community in our country has failed us for the past 20 years in so many ways. And I think it's time for a new look and relook at American power, and it projects throughout the world.
CBS military analyst Major Mike Lyons. Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, Colleen.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. This is Seattle's Morning News. Last year, nearly a quarter of Washington's school districts had zero teachers of color. This was in a piece in the Seattle Times. And I know you've heard this before, but what research is finding is that when a student doesn't have a teacher that looks like him or her, not good things happen. The student can't really excel. And for the teacher corps in Washington State to be representative of the population, you would need, for example, 22,300 more non-white teachers. And the biggest gap is not in the black population, but the Hispanic and Latino population, where you'd need 12,000 just to reflect the population. And so a kid would have at least a decent chance of seeing at least one teacher who shares culture, race, and other things with him or her. So when you dig down into the story, what you find is one of the reasons it's so difficult to get minority teachers certified is because of the test they have to pass. And I thought to myself, well, this should be easy to fix. So let's call somebody who knows about this, and that would be Nate Bowling, who teaches AP government at Lincoln High School. And I know this has been a particular crusade of yours, Nate. What can you tell me about this test and whether it is indeed the bottleneck that needs to be fixed?
So I frankly don't think the tests are as big of a barrier or nearly the issue. I think that there are isolated incidents, and we can point to the test and say that the tests are an issue. There's like certain like outrageous circumstances and cases. But I think there's a bigger issue just within schools that people of color don't have a positive experience always in school, and so they don't feel comfortable returning there to be teachers.
So the problem starts well before the test, you're saying. There just isn't the same. There isn't just that desire to be a teacher?
Well, think about it this way. If you spend 13 years in a bureaucratic system where you don't feel valued, where you feel like you are facing disproportionate discipline, and you feel like you're going to a school that's under-resourced and understaffed, why would you want to return to that building or that community or that culture and be a part of it?
Well, to break the cycle.
Well, for sure. But if you're a talented person of color with options, let's say that you're a person who's like in the Yakima area and you have excellent mathematical skills. And so like you go to Davis High School or Eisenhower High School, whatever Yakima school, and then you go and you get a degree in math. Are you going to come back and work in a school system where you didn't feel valued?
Well, I guess probably not. But you'd work somewhere, wouldn't you?
Well, you'd work somewhere, but if your degree's in math, like you could work for Amazon or Starbucks or, well, not Starbucks. Well, Starbucks, sure, but Amazon or Microsoft. And so this is the thing. The job of being a teacher is a very difficult job, and many students have unpleasant experiences in public school, and they don't choose to return there. So, like, to me, if we want to increase teacher diversity, we have to make the experiences that students of color have in school more enjoyable and make schools places that they want to return to.
Mm-hmm. But this sounds like a chicken and egg thing. One of the reasons that students don't have this positive experience in school is because they don't see teachers who look like them, at least according to the research.
That's correct. And it is a chicken and egg thing. And so you talked about interrupting the cycle. And like, that's kind of one of the reasons why I'm a classroom teacher. Like, I have a mission kind of worldview about the work that I do. Mm-hmm. And like, my job and my goal is to interrupt cycles.
So how many of your students are going to become teachers?
So I'll say this. I've worked in Tacoma schools for 13 years, and for the first 12 years of my career, I never worked with another general education black male teacher. Mm-hmm. And now we have one in the building, and he's a former student of mine. And in fact, he's somebody who I had freshman year, sophomore year, senior year, and somebody who I gave the toast at his wedding, and now he's a teacher in my building.
Well, at least there's one.
That's one. Well, but and so one of the things I'm really passionate about is growing my teacher tree. So I have Corey here in the building. I have Taisha in Oklahoma. And so like one thing that I've done is in my government class in the past, if I had a student who was really good at explaining court cases,
yeah.
I used to say like, you know what? You should go into law. I've stopped saying that. If they can explain difficult content now, I say you should think about teaching.
Think about teaching. And then what do they say?
It's a mix. Sometimes they're like, you know, I have thought about teaching, or they're like, I can't do what you do, or I don't want to do what you do. Or, you know, sometimes they're really funny. They're like, I can't deal with these kids. but like, it's hard to get somebody to be and to want to be what they don't see. And so if I'm the only black male teacher that these students have, then like I have an obligation to talk particularly to black male students about why I teach and how much I enjoy teaching. A couple of years ago, I went to a conference in Philadelphia. It was the Black Male Educators Conference. And like the stat that they kept saying was just like 2% not enough. Black males are 2% of the teaching force. And if given all the inequities that we have in schools and giving disproportionate discipline and giving all the stats we see about racial disproportionality, I think the system would be helped by having more black male educators.
Yeah, I think that's pretty clear. I don't think actually many people, even those who are skeptical about this whole line of inquiry, would dispute that at this point. So,
well, and I'll add, there's it's not just about black students or white students or whatever, but like I think that having more people of color in positions of expertise would actually be deleterious to racism in America. Yeah. Like, it's hard for you to sit back and say, oh, black people are inferior when your calculus teacher is a black person.
Exactly. The trouble is, though, it sounds to me, based on your experience, if we wait for people to become teachers as their first career, we're going to be waiting a long time. Is there any way of recruiting people who have already maybe had a career and now want to do something for the good of the country to come back and teach?
Well, I think career changers oftentimes make really good teachers. They have life experience. In fact, I work with a co-teacher right now who's in her first year, but she's 29 years old and spent a bunch of time doing nonprofit work. Mm-hmm. And so she has a sense of like dealing with people in a way that a first-year teacher doesn't have. Also, I think grow your own programs are really important. Here in Tacoma, we have a program called Teach 253. And basically what we do is we get students who are in high school into classrooms doing observations. And they do the class for two periods a day. And then at the end of the year, they can sit down and take the para test. And the para test allows them to be a classroom aide when they finish their associate's degree. And then after that, if they finish their bachelor's degree and get a teaching cert, they're guaranteed to interview in Tacoma. And so, like, what better way to get more teachers of color than to recruit the students who are already in our school system?
Sure, sure. So what can white teachers do to make up for the lack of non-white teachers while we're waiting for them to be recruited?
I think there's a couple of things that teachers can do kind of writ large. One, if you see somebody who's a leader in a classroom and is really good with content explaining things, then, like, talk to them and nudge them towards teaching. Two, oftentimes teachers talk down the profession. Like, I love what I do. It's hard. It's draining work. And like, I'm exhausted right now. But talking down the profession and the work that we do is really, really not helpful. And then the last thing I would say is think about school discipline practices that you have. The vast majority of office referrals come from a small minority of teachers. And if you're a teacher and you're sending the same kind of kids to the office every day, maybe you need to look at your own practice. Maybe you're the problem, not the kids.
Yeah. So if everything goes right, how many years will it be before you see at least some progress in the proportion of non-white teachers in Washington State?
So this is my 13th year of teaching, and this year Corey's in the building, and I've got another crop that are in undergrad and going through grad school. And so I can say, like, for my building, for Lincoln High School, that change and shift is on the way.
And you would attribute that to talking positive about the profession, recruiting people, do you have to be subtle, or can you just get in somebody's face and say, you need to teach?
It takes all types. So there's some that you're really subtle with, and there's some who kind of get dragged kicking and screaming into the idea. Like, I did not start off as a teacher. I worked in logistics management for a while and didn't start teaching until I was 27. So I was a career changer myself. But like, one of the things that like I know about teaching is that teaching is sales. And so like, I can't have the same approach to every possible teacher candidate. And the flip side is like, this job isn't for everybody. Like, there are some students who, like, I don't care how good they are explaining stuff, like, mm-hmm. they don't have the organizational skills to do it. And so, like, I don't counsel them into it.
Yeah. Nate Bowling, who teaches at Lincoln High School. Nate, thanks very much.
My pleasure, Dave.
Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Are you within your rights to secretly record a public official? Like the cop stopping you for speeding, for example. without telling the cop you have a recorder running. Let's consult with former State Attorney General Rob McKenna. Our conversation brought to you by Terra Firma Foundation Systems and Aristapoint Employee Benefit Consultants. What was the situation involved in this case, Rob?
Well, first of all, we're talking about the state of Massachusetts, which has a wiretap statute dating all the way back to 1968. Which prohibits wiretaps without a court order, but which the police have been using in Suffolk County and the Boston area to go after people who were secretly recording their interactions with the police. So there's no question here about being able to openly record. The question is whether or not someone who has secretly recorded the police or potentially other government officials can be charged. And apparently, since 2011, the district attorney in Suffolk County has opened 11 felony cases under this statute, and the Boston police have filed charges against at least nine people. This case comes up because the ACLU challenged the use of the wiretap statute to go after people for secretly recording the police. And then in a kind of man bites dog angle, a very conservative and controversial group called Project Veritas, which is led by James O'Keefe, they also challenged this law because they want to be able to secretly record their interactions with government officials. And the federal district court judge ruled in favor of both groups, in favor of the ACLU, which thinks it should be able to secretly record police, and for Mr. O'Keefe and Project Veritas. So it was quite a turn of events there.
Well, then, does this again? This is in the state of Massachusetts, but it was ruled on in a federal court, right?
So in Washington State, we have our own rule. It's called the two-party rule, where you have to have the permission of both parties in order to record, which law enforcement doesn't like because it makes it harder to send somebody in, wearing a wire to record the bad guys. And the law itself is apparently the result of some very senior legislators back in the 70s getting wind of the fact they were being investigated by federal law enforcement. And they passed this law apparently to make it harder for them to be investigated. But because this decision was made by this federal district court judge on First Amendment grounds, in fact, people have a right under the First Amendment to record the private conversations of government officials in public places. Mm-hmm. It could affect our two-party consent rule here, potentially.
So I guess it depends on how you define a public place. So in the scenario that I mentioned, you're right. Stopped by a cop for speeding, and you fire up your iPhone because you want to make a record of this transaction. The iPhone is sitting in your car, which I believe has been ruled a private space in some decisions. The police officer is outside the car in the public space.
Right.
Would this still apply?
I'm not sure it would. I think you would have an argument that particularly if you just put the iPhone up on the dashboard where it was visible, and especially if you notify the officer, you should be able to record the interaction. I don't think there's a basis for him refusing to allow you to do that. If you secretly record it and then you publicize it, right now the police officer might have an argument that you violated the two-party consent rule. But then you might now have a First Amendment reason, except for this. If you're a private individual who's been pulled over for speeding, it isn't really clear that you have a First Amendment interest that's related to news gathering and information of, dissemination of public information. Mm-hmm. It does seem more private there. So I would proceed with caution, and anyone who is thinking about recording an interaction would be better off just doing it in the open and not trying to do it secretly.
And again, this is a Massachusetts case and has been ruled on by a district court, which would not govern here in Washington State, correct?
Correct. It just might give you an argument if someone comes after you under our two-party consent rule, if that is to say if someone in the government comes after you. At least you'd have a case you could point to and you'd have an argument you could make. But you're right. The decision of a federal district court judge in Massachusetts is not binding on any judge here. But at the same time, the Ninth Circuit might be influenced by the First Circuit's reasoning if the First Circuit stood by the district court judge's decision.
Right. So it only applied to us if it got to the Supreme Court level and was ruled a part of the First Amendment right.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly right. And, this is the kind of case might go up that high. I don't know if the Suffolk County District Attorney is going to appeal it. But in my experience, the Supreme Court has a hard time resisting a juicy First Amendment issue that they haven't dealt with before. I mean, all three of my cases in the Supreme Court had that characteristic. And, that's, for example, why we have a top two primary now, is because the Supreme Court decided to hear our appeal from an adverse ruling in the Ninth Circuit that had struck down our top two primary.
Well, when it comes to recording, every public official should simply assume they're being recorded. I mean, isn't that the way it is?
Yeah, that would be wise. And now, of course, members of the public ought to assume it as well.
That's true.
With the ubiquity of body cams, police body cameras, I think it's more and more common. And you have dashboard cameras. I mean, there's an entire industry pushing this video out on YouTube and on reality TV.
Former State Attorney General Rob McKenna, our conversation brought to you by Terra Firma Foundation Systems and Arista Point Employee Benefit Consultants. Thanks, Rob.
Thanks, Dave.
Your daily dose of kindness, brought to you by Spring Free Trampoline. An Arizona man didn't let international borders stop him from fulfilling a little girl's Christmas wish. Randy Heiss was on a hike when he found a popped balloon tangled in some bushes. He then noticed something attached to it.
I saw the little note on the bottom of the ribbon, and I said, oh, got to take a picture. So I took a picture of that, and then I unfolded the note, and I saw that it was written in Spanish from a little girl named Dayami.
Dayami. That's who it was from. She's from Nogales in Mexico. She and her siblings had sent their Christmas wishes to Santa up in the air. Randy told KVOA-TV that he was determined to help bring the magic of Christmas to her. So he turned to a radio station in her town for help. And through broadcast and Facebook, they found her. Once connected, Randy and his wife delivered the toys to Dayami and her siblings. Randy says it was equally special to watch the pure joy of the kids receiving those gifts.
We lost our only son 9 years ago, so we don't have grandchildren in our future. And so really getting to share Christmas with kids was something that's been missing in our lives.
A sweet story. These Daily Dose of Kindness stories, easy to come by around Christmas time. I'll have more as the year moves on.
Oh!
Time for Choke Points at 8:46. Sully is enjoying some time off, so Tracy Taylor has this morning's, brought to you by Online Trading Academy.
This is your reminder that we're a little over 2 weeks away from the viaduct shutdown, nicknamed the Seattle Squeeze, or what DOT is calling Real Line 99.
We call it Real Line 99 because essentially what we're doing is we're taking the main line SR99, which is currently in a detoured configuration around where Bertha was launched from and the North Portal area, and we're straightening it out and putting it into the tunnel. And that's this three-week period that we need to do, build embankments, tear embankments apart, build barrier, stripe, and those types of things.
So hopefully you've been working with your employer on changing how your work schedule will go or planning your new normal into and out of the city come January 11th. Now, during the viaduct briefing last week, Mayor Durkan made it very clear that this is going to dramatically change on how people get around the city.
People have to understand that this new normal will last years, not months. Because of the number of mega construction projects coming online.
And when the viaduct closure happens on the 11th, it's the elevated portion of the viaduct that closes. This has nothing to do with the Battery Street Tunnel.
I want to reiterate that the Battery Street Tunnel is not being closed fully during this three-week period. One lane in each direction, again, trying to provide some relief to folks going to the north end. There will be a lane there at Western to merge onto Battery Street at the South Portal, and then also to exit through Battery Street Tunnel to Western and Elliott. So that will remain open, but essentially the viaduct, the elevated portion of the structure will all be closed.
The Nisqually earthquake in 2001 did damage to the viaduct over the years, and it's become a safety issue.
That needs to come down. This is a safety project. This is why we built the tunnel, is to provide a safe route through the city of Seattle that's designed for a 2,500-year earthquake. That's a 9.0 magnitude earthquake, and that this structure, the viaduct, clearly could not handle that type of ground motion. The decommissioning of the Battery Street Tunnel and then the reconnecting of the North Surface Streets are also important parts of this project.
Seattle DOT Heather Marks mentioned they have added cameras to help keep traffic moving.
We've added traffic cameras and other monitoring devices throughout the system so that we can pay attention to as many corners as possible.
And Seattle DOT also asked that drivers be patient.
This is going to be a really stressful time, but we have to be compassionate with each other and we have to be compassionate with ourselves. So take a breath, no shouting. No need for that. That's going to make things a lot safer for everybody and also more comfortable.
Listen, we're going to make this as easy as possible for you. Sully will be covering commutes from the North Sound, and I'm going to be focusing on the South and East Side. And if you think this is not going to affect you and your daily routine, think again. Now, stay with us during this transition. We will walk you through everything you need to stay ahead of the gridlock. Tracy Taylor, Cairo Radio, real-time traffic.
Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. There is nothing more debilitating than a surprise headache right in the middle of your work day, so let's see what we can do about it. Let's call the doctor.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Let's see if we can discuss the subject of headaches without giving people one, Dr. Cohen. What's the latest research on headaches?
Well, good morning, Dave. Headaches is a great topic because actually headache is one of the most common and debilitating pain conditions that exists in the world. And actually, according to the World Health Organization, about half of the adults in the world have had a headache in the past year. So it's really, really common. There's not many things that we can say that about. And also, the World Health Organization names headache as the third leading cause of disability in the world and the number one cause of disability in individuals under the age of 50. So headaches are really a significant problem. In addition, headaches are a major cause of absenteeism from work and from school, and they can also really play a big role on and take a big toll on in terms of your social life and family life. And headaches don't spare anybody. They don't spare you based on your age. They don't spare you based on your gender, your race, or your geographical location. Everybody gets headaches. So it's a real, real issue.
What is actually going on inside your head when a headache happens?
Yeah, so, you know, headaches really describe the location. It's actually happening in your head, but there can be a whole host of different causes. In fact, the International Headache Society has a classification that includes over 150 different headache categories. So there's a lot of different types of headaches. But if we stick to the main one, so for example, a tension-type headache, which people often talk about, and they'll say, gosh, I have a tension headache. Well, these tend to be like mild to moderate, and they're non-throbbing headaches, and they often occur on both sides of the head, and they usually don't get worse with routine activities like bending over, walking stairs, or whatever. And in general, tension-type headaches tend to be more mild, and people can usually treat them successfully with over-the-counter medication. And oftentimes, they're results of, you know, tightening of the muscles or a stress or strain in the back of our neck, and it radiates up into our head. And so that's what's really going on there. Migraines, and you'll often hear people when they have bad headache saying, I've got a migraine. Now, we don't really completely understand exactly what's going on with migraines, but you know, migraine pain is more moderate to severe pain, and it's often described as a pounding or throbbing pain, and they can really last from anywhere from 4 hours to 3 days. But usually migraines are associated with other symptoms. So usually people have sensitivity to light, they'll want to be in a dark room.
Or auras.
They know it's coming. Or they'll be sensitive to noises or odors. And in some more severe cases, people have nausea and vomiting associated with it. Or they'll just have stomach upset or abdominal pain. So migraines are really a different category. And those are unlikely to go away with just a bath or exercise. And people, there's been a lot, people who have migraines, there actually hasn't been a whole lot of good drugs to treat migraines. There's some that have been developed over the past decade or so that have been, you know, moderately efficacious, but they're not great at treating migraines. But fortunately, there's new hope for people because all of a sudden there's three new drugs.
That's what I saw, the three new drugs, and they're going to start testing them soon.
Yeah. So this is really a new class of drugs that's been approved by the FDA. And actually, the drugs are actually quite expensive. It's about $7,000 a year, and they have to be given by injection.
I promised we would discuss this without giving people headaches.
So the migraine sufferers may not like hearing this, okay. But the good news is that this new class of drugs is very efficacious at preventing people from getting migraines. And that's the whole point of it, that this is really a preventative therapy for people.
So you take it just all the time?
Yeah, it's actually an injection right now.
Oh, really?
All three of the approved migraine drugs require delivery by injection. But one of the companies, Allergan, is working on pills that would basically deliver the similar migraine-fighting compounds, both preventative and acute treatment. So this is being worked on, but it's not there right now. But the good news is for migraine sufferers is that there is hope on the way. It's thought that about a third of the people who are chronic migraine sufferers would actually benefit from this new class of migraine drugs.
That's good news. I'm just surprised that with all the technology we have, they still can't figure it out. Because this is a physical thing going on in the brain, right? I mean, well, we're able to track sometimes the brain's reaction to thoughts and words, and we still can't figure out why migraines happen, huh?
Well, we're starting to understand it better. I was able to just describe the mechanism of how it happens, but we don't necessarily understand well the external factors that stimulate it. And this class of drugs is directed at the neuropeptides that are responsible for causing the migraine. So we do understand part of the mechanism of how it happens, but we don't understand the entire pathway because we don't necessarily understand the stimuli for it. But the other thing is that only addresses migraine headaches. When the medical community has identified 150 different types of headaches, headaches, it's really a problem. Now, a lot of people experience secondary headaches, and one of the more common ones is actually sinus headaches. They're treatable, but not by trying to treat the headache, because you got to treat the underlying cause. You got to treat the sinus problem.
Yeah. So then, as a rule of thumb, at what point do you go to a doctor when you can't get rid of your headache on your own with the normal procedure?
Well, I think the time to see a doctor is when headaches become more progressive and when they start to occur with other neurologic symptoms, because these can be a sign of a disease process in the brain. I don't want to scare people, because it's the old thing of looking on, you know, the internet and doing a search. I have a headache, and in the differential diagnosis is a brain tumor. Yeah. Like, headaches do not necessarily represent brain tumors, but when it becomes chronic, when it's not going away, when you have other associated symptoms, when it's getting worse over time, then it's time to see your doctor.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
Derek, a federal jobs guarantee. So essentially, the government would have to give a job to anybody who couldn't find one any other way?
That's correct. Anybody who's willing and able to work, the federal government would guarantee a job for them, a job with dignity, so that there's the assurance of a decent wage and decent benefits, as well as a productive job aimed at building our infrastructure, or human or physical infrastructure.
So what kind of jobs are these?
So you could certainly see the roads and bridges that are crumbling in America that need a great deal of investment. But we can look beyond just physical infrastructure and think about a 21st century infrastructure to include things like care work. So imagine if we had high quality elder care, high quality child care, the gender components that would have on the U.S. economy. Right now, we designate that work largely to women, whether it's by choice or not. One, it doesn't have the accompaniment of a wage, but it's obviously productive work that needs to be done. But the second thing is that women that are currently engaged in it, if there was a workforce ready and able to fulfill that work, then they would be able to go into the labor market and pursue other interests that they may have. Other types of job could be, you know, we are facing, we can see with the environmental crises that come about from climate change, we could green our entire economy with a federal job guarantee. Imagine if we just refit every home in America so that it was energy efficient and not, you know, not taxing so much fossil fuels, et cetera, et cetera.
There's a pretty good argument to say that we're pretty close to full employment now. I mean, unemployment rates are pretty low, and the people who are having trouble getting jobs are people who don't have the skills that are in demand anymore. I mean, what do you do if somebody's only skill is to be on an assembly line, for example, and those jobs are fast disappearing, or, you know, coal mining, and you no longer have coal mining jobs? What do you do?
I mean, saying we're at full employment almost becomes an oxymoron. Take, for instance, the black unemployment rate. The black unemployment rate is well above 7%. If that was the national unemployment rate, we would say we're in an employment crisis. We also have a great deal of underemployment if we use a criteria besides the traditional unemployment rate, but think about people who are in precarious employment situations. We would see that even in this period of perceived expansion and I put around quotes, full employment, we're not really at full employment. So in a time period like this, the program would not be as big because the private sector is employing a good number of people. So the program that we're talking about is counter-cyclical. When we get into an economic crisis, the program would take up a much larger share of the labor force. In periods like this, it would not need to employ as much. The other point that you raised about, is it an issue of skills that workers are underemployed or not employed? We continually have more workers looking for jobs than there are actual jobs. So given that simple variance, it's never the case that skills is the only driving force of unemployment in the U.S. economy.
You're not worried that by doing this, you might just force more companies to move those jobs overseas?
Yep. So I was almost anticipating that question because I was about to explain that. So some people argue that you will crowd out the low-wage labor market in the U.S. My response is, well, that's an added benefit, not necessarily a detraction. So if we start losing low-wage jobs that are precarious anyway, that leave workers vulnerable to have more secure employment, it's not, we're not proposing something where workers will be more likely unemployed because we're guaranteeing a job. But if a job like a low-wage job in a fast food industry becomes automated, or if other low-wage worker transfers overseas, that's not necessarily a bad thing. I think we want American workers not only employed, but employed in good jobs. That's the criteria, not just a job. And I guess that would be a critique of some of the rhetoric from the Trump administration. It's not just a job that Americans want. Americans want good jobs.
Does anyone with any power in government support your idea?
I'd say this idea is picking up a lot of steam. We're honored that Politico 50, Politico magazine comes out with a list of 50 innovative ideas per year. And my colleague, William Darity at Duke University, we both made the list. So probably 5 or 10 years ago, that would not have been thought of, that an idea like this could make it to the mainstream. If you look at some of the rhetoric from the platform of the Democratic Party, in essence, they're calling for a federal job guarantee. They don't go so far as to say it just yet, but what would be consistent with what they're calling for is a federal job guarantee.
Well, Democrats have called for that for a long time. I mean, that was Hubert Humphrey's platform. There's been some talk, I believe, in the past about this grand bargain between liberals and conservatives, where the government would provide a job guarantee and this this universal basic income that you've talked about, and in exchange, welfare is eliminated. No more welfare. Would you go for that?
The social safety net that we spend right now would dramatically be reduced with a federal job guarantee. Obviously, things like unemployment insurance would be dramatically reduced. Dramatically reduced would also be things like SNAP and AFDC. Would we go so far as to have to eliminate them? Well, there are still some people that have limiting disabilities that inhibit their abilities to work. So we don't have to get rid of the entire social safety net. But it would be better to have a social safety net that provides an actual job that allows people to interact in a social, meaningful way to decrease things like depression, rather than relying simply on subsistent programs that we currently administer to our poor and working poor.
Mm-hmm. But so far, Paul Ryan hasn't tweeted his approval to you on this.
Not quite. But, you know, it is, as you kind of alluded to a little bit, it's a conservative idea. We're talking about work, productive work.
That's
you
right.
know, I think when you poll Americans, they want to work. It's a misnomer that we have this lazy class of individuals that would opt for a government subsidy without any attachment of work, as opposed to just having something that's leading to a job with dignity, that's productive, and they can see the fruits of their labor.
Seattle's Morning News with Dave Ross. I'm Carolyn Osorio. When you're a child who's been disappointed by adults, a steady hand through that stormy childhood is a boon. That's where Friends of the Children comes in.
The guy who started Friends of the Children is a guy named Duncan Campbell, and he grew up in Portland, and he certainly grew up under some adverse circumstances, and as he became successful in his own life, he wanted to pay that back to young people. And I think what was special about Duncan is that Duncan really wanted to invest in the research. And from the research that that he contracted very early in the process, what we realized is that consistency is most important for these young people. So if we're going to make a difference in their lives, what they need is a stable, committed, caring adult over the long term. So while it's very possible to pair a volunteer mentor with a youth and have that be successful, we can't really take the risk of it not being successful. And so what we do is we pay our mentors a professional educator's salary. It's benefited with retirement, and we ask our mentors for at least a 3-year commitment. But across the country, our average commitment by the mentors is 7 years. And what that does is it means that whereas role models in the past may have been transitory, they may have seen, family, parents, caregivers go in and out of their lives, we're there to provide a consistent, stable role model. And we've found that more than anything else contributes to success graduating high school and beyond.
Steve Lewis with Friends of the Children says their mentors are in it for the long haul, 4 hours a week, from kindergarten to the age of 18.
Kindergarten through fifth grade, half of that time is spent in the classroom. After fifth grade, half of the time is spent on school success. And so we really do find that it's really important, whether it's coming back to the friend's office down on Rainier or going to a local library, just sitting down and focusing and getting those academics done and making sure that we're setting goals and achieving them with the young people. A lot of effort is put into intentionality. So, for example, when you're in second grade, you might do a cooking project with one of our mentors. And so that cooking project is, you know, baking a cake or it's making nutritious snacks. But when they're doing that, they're not only learning about what cooking is, they're learning about how to measure. They're learning about, you know, what's in what we cook and what they should be using. We help them plan financially. So that if they go to the store, they can buy things that are going to both be healthy and nutritious and cheap for the family. But everything that we do is oriented around a set of goals and is monitored by the mentors, but at the same time is awesome and fun.
And the sad fact is there's no shortage of children in our region who need a good friend.
We might find a young person who, you know, might have the same clothes on a couple days in a row, and we might see them in the lunchroom by themselves. And in our screening process, we'll ask questions of the teachers and the principals, but we'll also connect with the lunch lady, the janitor, and really find out what they've observed among the young people. And when we start working with them, we start with at least half of our time in the schools. So from kindergarten to fifth grade, we'll spend at least 2 hours a week during the school year with the kids side by side in the school. And that really goes a long way to generating trust for the teachers, because we can be an asset and a support to the teachers as well as the student.
Friends of the Children also focuses on developing grit in kids.
The past research really said, you know, we're going to commit to just pounding the academics, right? So we're going to double the literacy work. We're going to double the academic work. And we found that while that can get a kid through high school, it's ultimately not going to be the most predictive of long-term success. The things that are predictive of long-term success, interestingly enough, are things like grit, resilience, goal setting, things that are hard to measure, but that educators and researchers have really committed themselves towards measuring. So while we're an academic program to some extent, we're more a program that uses academics as a context to build things like grit and resilience and goal setting, which is actually what we measure in our program on a day-to-day basis with our mentors, because we know once kids graduate from high school, those are the skills that are going to propel them into success beyond high school.
And Steve says committing to kids at kindergarten in their program is a double-edged sword because it means they can't help every kid.
What we're really about, stopping intergenerational poverty in its tracks. And when we do that, we really have to commit to a kid over the long term, because when we can change one kid's life and be very certain that we'll change that young person's life, then we know that that person is going to go back into their community. They're going to be a successful parent, a successful community member, a successful job holder, and a successful leader. And so our work is not just about changing the lives of individuals, but changing the lives of communities.
That's why Bonneville Seattle is proud to partner with the Seattle Seahawks, Carter Subaru, and 3010 Weight Loss for Life in honoring Friends of the Children as our charity of the month. Find out more at MyNorthwest.com.